1997 Sunstone Symposium presents session number 134, a panel discussion, Families Are Forever, Parents of Children Who Have Followed a Different Path, with Robin Kennedy Davis, Rob Stephenson, Rick Koontz, and Jan McConkey.
Well, I'm going to get started on time so that we have plenty of time to have some discussion afterwards. The title of the panel is Families Are Forever, Parents of Children Who Have Followed a Different Path. Despite valiant efforts to raise children that model our belief in Mormonism, follow Christ's commandments, live healthy, happy, and productive lives, our sons and daughters sometimes take a different path. This path leads some to criminal activity, alcoholism, drug abuse, unwanted pregnancy, homosexuality, dropping out of school, or simply leaving the church. This panel will explore the feelings of the parents as they deal with children walking down these various paths. And I want to emphasize just one thing before we begin. This discussion really is not centered at all on the children and their activities and the paths that they have followed. It is on the parents, how we are handling it, how we are dealing with it, and our feelings as we struggle to relate with these children. I am Robin Davis, and I will be narrating the panel. I'm a member of the Sunstone Board of Trustees, and I also am a member of the Odyssey House Board of Trustees and a mother of four. Also on our panel today, and I will be first, second will be Rob Stephenson. And Rob has a PhD. He is a lifetime active member of the church and a seminary instructor and a lifetime educator. Our third speaker is Jan McConkey. Jan is a neighbor of mine, or an ex-neighbor of mine. Jan is got her BA in psychology, and she's a mother and housewife and has five children. And my fourth panelist, if he can make it, is David Yolkstetter. And David is a healthcare consultant. He works for Medicode as a strategic development, and he is father of five children. Last February, a friend of mine called and told me about an Ensign article that she had read entitled When Our Children Go Astray by Elder John K. Carmack. She had been dealing with a child who had been in a drug coma, and she found the article useful and wanted to draw my attention to it because she knew I was struggling with a rebellious teenager. Let me just explain a little bit about my situation and what I'm dealing with, or what I've been dealing with. And as I said, let me emphasize, this is a child I love very much. I always thought that my third child, Abby, would be my easiest child. When she was very young, she was totally undemanding in comparison to my two older children. And when she entered the junior high school in 7th and 8th grade, let me show you. This was, I think, Abby in 8th grade. Sometimes visually, when you see these children, maybe it'll help you understand a little bit about what we went through. She was an all-state gymnast and really an athlete. And I'd always been told, keep your kids really involved in athletics and they'll stay away from trouble. And in 9th grade, she was a cheerleader. She had fantastic friends. I loved her. The kids she associated with, and she was wholesome, popular, athletic, intelligent, everything you could expect from a child. As a sophomore, she started Skyline, and she had been swimming all along. She started swimming for Skyline, and as a sophomore, she took 8th in the state in the butterfly, 10th in the backstroke. She was just a superb athlete. She would go every morning for 2 hours before school, 2 hours after school for swimming. And shortly after, when she started 10th grade, that was about the time I'd been divorced for 5 years, and I remarried, and we moved to a new home. And she was really eager to move with us. She still wanted to go back and attend Skyline. So she started 11th grade at Skyline. And about this time, and I'm not sure exactly what happened, but her friends changed. And she told me it was because, she said, "Mom, my friends that you thought were so wonderful were starting to do drugs. And I knew I couldn't be around them." So what she chose, she kind of started snowboarding. And she got in with a group of kids snowboarding that had some pretty unusual ideas. They're what are called straight edge. I don't know if any of you are familiar with the straight edge game that's really prevalent on the east side. But it's a real unusual group of kids. They abstain from drugs and alcohol, but they also can be very violent. They like to enforce their beliefs on people. They are vegans, which is a very strict form of vegetarian. They will eat no animal products of any sort, nothing with gelatin, nothing with any kind of egg, cheese, milk. So it's a very restrictive diet. On top of that, my daughter also eliminated any kind of sugar or refined flour, which makes it very difficult to feed this young woman. On this diet, she was not able to continue her swimming. She had no energy. She was sick a lot. So she quit swimming in 10th grade, or in 11th grade. And about this time, she decided that she didn't like the kids at her high school and that she wanted to enroll in community college and get a graduate early. So we enrolled her in community college. The one thing about that is that there's really no one checking up on you. Well, after two quarters at Salt Lake Community College, she hadn't completed a course. She just simply wasn't showing up for class. And so essentially now she's behind instead of ahead in school and basically had dropped out of school. She was not real happy during this time either. And so together we started to... and this is Abby about at this age now in when she was 16 years old. And so at this juncture, during that summer, she really had kind of a crazy time. She shaved her head. She started to pierce everything you could pierce. She pierced her tongue and her nose and all kinds of things. And then she started tattooing her body. Right now, she has four tattoos, and they're major. They're all the way around her arm. They're this big up her calf. They're around her wrists, her ankles, anything to... And she loves her tattoos. She will wear a tank top. She shows... They're not the kind of tattoos you can hide. And I'm married to a plastic surgeon, and a lot of people think you can remove tattoos. These tattoos you will never be able to remove. They are with her forever. And she's planning on more of them. Also, she's just become very anti-society. Doesn't like our lifestyle. Would like to live in a little cabin in the woods. You know, the clothing that they wear, you know, totally ragged, baggy. And... this was the start of her senior year, and of course she can't see her tattoo. And the thing is she's still a beautiful girl. I still love her, but a lot of her decisions have been really hard on us. And because she was kind of not into the drug culture and the alcohol, her way to rebel was during her junior year she would disappear. She would disappear for like 3 or 4 days at a time. And no one knew where she was. None of her friends, her school, her work. That was her way to get our attention and say, "Look at me. I'm rebelling here. Pay attention to me." And so the start of her, what would be her senior year, we decided, and she agreed, to go live with my sister in Boulder, Colorado. And she went over there. She got away from her friends, and she started to do really well in school, got mostly A's, completed a semester over there. But when she came home at Christmas time, she started to miss her friends, and they pulled her back here to Salt Lake. And we're very lucky. She did just graduate. She finished up at West with her degree. I'm not saying we've turned any corners because I have a good relationship with Abby, but it is so hard to have someone who, a lot of her friends right now, even though she says she's not into the drugs, her boyfriend is, and her boyfriend is really the kind of guy that when he's on drugs mistreats her, and I just am struggling, you know, so much with her right now, and I know that that I'm in the midst of it, and that it will get better, but it has caused me so much heartache, and I have tried so hard to be a good example for her, and to and that's what's hard is when you as a parent have a child who just totally abandons what you believe is kind of the way to live and has chosen a different path. So that's what kind of prompted me to do this panel. And let me just explore a couple of things that I have found that have helped me. And one of them, friends of mine have referred me to the book Reviving Ophelia, which talks about adolescent girls and the struggles that adolescent girls have. And she has a chapter in here on divorce, and it is particularly hard on adolescent girls when their parents divorce. And I know that. But oftentimes, it isn't a choice that you have. And the woman who wrote the book, she said that in the 1990s, she said, "I try harder than I did in the 1970s to keep couples together and to teach them what they need to know to live a lifetime with another human being." She said, "In the 70s, I used to believe that a couple was better to be out of a bad marriage than they were to try and stay in it and work together." She said, "Now I try and counsel them to do the opposite, to stay together for the kids." Let me just read you one quote. She said, "Divorce is particularly tough for adolescents, partly that's because of their development level, and partly it's because teenagers require so much energy from parents. Teenagers need parents who will talk to them, supervise them, help them stay organized, and support them when they're down. Divorcing parents often just don't have the energy to give. Adolescents feel an enormous sense of loss of their parents, their families, and their childhood. And unlike younger children, when they express their pain, they are likely to do so in more dangerous ways." The other thing I learned is that teenagers can and really do manipulate divorced parents. They will choose to live with a parent that is more permissive, that has fewer rules and least supervision. And I noticed this really happened with my second oldest son, Tyler. He was 14 when I became divorced. And during that time, I would do anything to keep my family together. I wanted my four children together. I did not want some living with their dad and some living with their mom. And so I let him get away with all kinds of garbage because I did not want to break up the family. And finally, when he was about 16, and I could take it no longer, and I said to him, "Go live with your dad because I cannot stand you any longer." It was the best thing in the world for him and for me. And we have a fabulous relationship now, and that was a very good experience for him. As I mentioned, divorce is not always avoidable, and it's not always a mistake. I was married 19 years, but the last 4 years of that, I was separated. My husband had been a bishop, he was a physician, but during that time he had two or three separate affairs. He left the home and then he moved back. He left the home. We had years of counseling, and then when we finally decided to end the marriage and move on with our lives, I think it was the best thing. It was the only thing that we could do at that point. So I spent 5 years as a divorced parent, and during that 5 years, I really emphasized my children. They were my life. I had three teenagers, and I really felt like I made them my number one priority. And maybe that was why it was hard when I remarried for my daughter, because Children, especially young adolescents, don't see parents' needs at all. All they see are their needs, and they don't care whether your parent is happy or unhappy in their marriage. And I think that after I remarried, I think it was hardest on my daughter, Abby. I stayed active in the church during this time. I felt like the most important thing for me was to keep going to church, keep taking my kids to church, and to stay strong. I still teach Relief Society in my ward. When my kids were young, I just thought it was so easy. I thought I could be a perfect mother. I thought I'd have no problems with rebellious teenagers, and, you know, then they hit adolescence, and I just struggle all the time now. And I want to emphasize that Abby may be my hardest child right now, but I probably love her more because she has been so hard. She also has a great relationship with her father. She's living with him right now, but it is hard because he has a very different set of values. He's kind of basically left the church. He was the one who signed her permission to get her first tattoo at age 16, and I would never have done that. I would have said, Abby, you wait till you're 18, and then it's your decision. I will never give you permission to do that right now. And so it's hard when you have parents who maybe do have two little bit different set of values. I just want to list in here some things that they talk about that teenage girls really need and that may help and has helped me. Number one is certain kinds of homes help offer girls both protection and challenges. Girls hear the message, I love you, but I have expectations. What holds girls' lives in place is love and respect for their parents. I know Jan and I were talking about this the other day. When we grew up, we would have never done anything to embarrass our parents or to, you know, part of it was our personality, and we were not maybe the rebellious type, but we had so much love and respect for our parents that we did not want to harm their good name. Number two, parents can help by listening to their daughters who need as much parent time as toddlers. And sometimes we forget that they really do need our time and attention as much as those little toddlers. Teenagers need parents available when they are ready to talk. Number three, when teenagers temporarily lose their heads, which most do, they need an adult there to help them recover. Panicky parents make things worse. Good parents manage to stay reasonably calm through the storms. Number four, parents can help their daughters by modeling wholeness and by setting a good example. If the parents are fighting midlife crisis and are all whacked out and not sure what they believe in anymore, it's hard to be setting an example for a teenager coming up. They don't look at their parents as a model or as an example. Number five, the average teen watches 4.5 hours of television a day. The APA found watching TV leads to antisocial behavior, gender stereotyping, and bad grades. Parents can help their daughters interpret the media. They can help them by providing alternative activities to spending that much time watching TV. Number six, a parent should be downplayed. It's healthy for daughters to have other things to be proud of besides their looks. Emphasize sports and talent. Number seven, it's good to encourage positive peer relations. And this can't be overemphasized. Everyone has said, you know, your children need to have great friends. And what they suggest is that parents have some power to influence this by who they invite. Over, maybe if your child is going on a trip, who they invite with them on a trip, what area of town they live in, what kinds of activities they choose to involve their children in, they have some influence. But I also know that if you've ever tried to tell a child, you cannot spend time with that person, you cannot be with this boyfriend, it is like impossible to totally control your friends, or the friends that the children will have. We need to remember that parents' influence is limited. They are neither all-knowing nor all-powerful. Parents can make a difference in the lives of their daughters only if the daughters are willing, and not all daughters are. Parents have choices, daughters have choices and responsibilities, but friends will have an impact and their culture will also have an impact. So I think if we remember that that adolescence is such a tough time for these girls, it's really the border between their childhood and their adulthood, and part of them is striving to break away from the family, part of them wants to still feel protected by the family. I think it makes it apparent how difficult this is. The other thing I wanted to mention in closing is I really did enjoy this article in the Ensign. It was so good to hear some things from the church that I haven't heard for a while. And I think that that it was real encouraging. So I just want to emphasize a couple of things they mentioned in there. They started out, they said, "We can and should expect much of our children, but we cannot force them into the Lord's mold. Our children will not stay with the church and live the gospel unless they want to. Once their wayward children grow up, the time may come when parents will need to adjust their present expectations and approach, accepting things as they are rather than continuing in turmoil." And it always helps me to remember that God had a rebellious son, Nephi had rebellious sons, and they were good parents. And that it doesn't totally reflect on the job I'm doing or my efforts in the outcome of my children. Their advice to parents is, number one, take care of yourself first. I was so glad to see that listed as number one, that don't let the chaos of their lives consume yours. You know, when things like that happen, it also can bring down the parents as well, and you need to really look at that. Number two, seek help. I strongly urge parents of drug and alcohol abusers to investigate the latest techniques and services available to rehabilitate youth. I passed out a handout. I mentioned before I work with Odyssey House, and they had a letter there to parents, and some of the suggestions in there are really helpful. The most important things is that early intervention is really crucial in drug and alcohol rehabilitation, and I have other parents who are going to talk about that a little bit more, so I won't dwell on that. But number three, never give up. If you cannot seem to reach your child or daughter now, you can at least keep trying and loving them. I think that's absolutely the most crucial thing. Do not turn your back on that child. Do not discard that child. Keep loving them. Keep supporting them. Keep helping them. And someday they may change and they may not. I just wanted to read a quote. This was written in 1929 by Elder Orison F. Whitney of the Quorum of Twelve. "You parents of the willful and the wayward, don't give them up, don't cast them off. They are not utterly lost. The shepherd will find his sheep. They were his before they were yours, long before he entrusted them to your care, and you cannot begin to love them as he loves them. They have but strayed in ignorance from the path of right, and God is merciful to ignorance. Only the fullness of knowledge brings the fullness of accountability. Our Heavenly Father is far more merciful, infinitely more charitable than even the best of his servants, and the everlasting gospel is mightier in power to save than our narrow, finite minds can comprehend." The next one is to avoid denial and undue feelings of blame. I think that's where we parents suffer the most, is we take the blame, and too often we also take the credit when our children achieve. I've been told, don't take any credit and don't take any blame. Maybe there's a happy middle there, but I think you just have to really be careful. When President Kimball stated no success can compensate for failure in the home, we should not take that to mean that parents who have indeed put great time, effort, and sacrifice into parenting and yet who have still not reaped the desired rewards have failed. Number five, try not to live through the achievements of your children. And that's hard if maybe you have a son who you wanted to take over your business and he has no interest or desire in following that path. It can be frustrating.
Well, it's equally or even more frustrating when you have a child who has had a drug problem and or whatever. But you have to not live your life through the achievements of your children. Some parents wisely place their own personal hopes, unwisely place their own personal hopes and dreams on the achievements of their children. Number 6, refrain from judging others unrighteously. Because God and Jesus Christ alone can judge fully what is in people's hearts, they alone can judge wisely and perfectly temper justice with mercy. Because our children follow a different course than we have taught them does not give us a license to reject them. And number 7, turn to the Savior, remember prayer. And lastly, sometimes you have to almost leave the 99 to go and search for the one. If you've really had a struggle with a child that has become deeply lost in drugs or alcohol, sometimes that may be what you have to do for a while to really help them. Is sometimes you do have to go leave the 99 and the healthy children and help the one who needs the help at that point. Anyway, I want to just now turn the time over to the rest of the panelists, and then hopefully we will also have some more time to have some questions and comments from the audience.
I asked Jan how much time she wants, and she says hardly any. I'm Rob Stephenson. Appreciate the opportunity to participate on this panel. I'd like to tell you a little bit about our family first. We're descendants from original Mormon pioneers, some of them that were leaders in the church. Catherine and I have been married for 44 years. We met on this campus. We were educated here. Our children were educated here. We've been privileged to have those opportunities. We have 5 children, 4 of which served missions. Our 5th child is an artist, and he is our gay son. I'd like to address the question of how did our son deal with his homosexuality? When he was in high school, he felt like he was the only one in the whole school who was gay. There was no one to turn to. There were no models to look at, nothing to see. He was afraid, isolated. And he was afraid to tell his parents because he was afraid we might send him down to BYU to participate in aversion therapies that were taking place at that time. So he didn't tell us. We were getting clues all along the way. In fact, we had clues from the time he was a little tiny boy. He used to like to dress up in his mother's clothes and prance around the room with other neighborhood kids. Dr. Richard Ferry, who's a psychiatrist, has said that given this behavior, you can predict 75% of the time the children will be gay, the boys will be gay. So he exhibited this behavior very young. He thought that he would have to live away from home, and he took an apartment for about 3 months in Salt Lake just to try it out on a feasibility basis to see if he could live alone, see if he could make it. His experiences with his bishops were very interesting. His first bishop really approached him with benign neglect, pretty much. There was very little comment, very little suggestion, very little instruction, no encouragement, but no chastisement. His second bishop, at age 19, said that he didn't know much about this, but let me know if there's anything I can do to help. His third bishop, bishop of a singles ward in Los Angeles, befriended Eric, recognized early on his situation, and it said, would you like to come and talk to me? So they became good friends. He gave our son a church job, but after a while, when Eric told him that he wouldn't be coming anymore, he wept. We appreciate the fact that none of these bishops chastised our son. This leads us to a question of, well, how did we deal with his homosexuality? We weren't, as I mentioned before, totally surprised when he announced at age 22 that he was gay. We were shocked to have it finally said, because we were hoping all along that this is something that would pass with time. We believe, like most people, that homosexuality is something that is influenced by others. You catch this, or you choose it, or something like this. We were of that ilk. And as a result, we were very shocked to find out finally that our son was gay. He had tried and tried and tried. And of the friends that we know who have gay children, they have all tried. None of them want to be gay. This is not something one goes out and chooses. There's no benefits from being gay in this society. They don't go out and choose it. Well, we also heard words like abomination that related to this phenomenon, which helped to alienate us and push us into a position of isolation and quiet. So we did. We kept quiet. But what did we do about it? We didn't stay quiet. We finally found out, with our son's help, of a group called Parents Who Care, People Who Care, which was a support group. And this is the first time we went and acknowledged verbally, out loud, that we had a gay son. This made us feel a little better, but we still had a long ways to go and a lot to learn. We joined a study group that met monthly, a group consisting of several professional therapists, several university professors who were studying the research regarding homosexuality. We learned a lot, and this resulted in the organization of the first conference on homosexuality here at the University of Utah, co-sponsored by the Graduate School of Social Work. Catherine and I handled the arrangements and managed the conference. This was 4 years ago. There have been annual conferences since that time, and some of the outstanding researchers in the country have been invited to come and participate and present their information. Among them, Roger Gorski from UCLA, Dean Hamer from the National Institute of Health, and several others. It has been an illuminating and educational experience to learn about homosexuality. The result of the conferences led to the establishment of a support group of LDS parents called Family Fellowship. The objectives of Family Fellowship are twofold. One is to keep families together. The second is to keep families in the church. We have participated in many family fellowship meetings and gatherings in which parents found out about us and wanted to come and join. Their reactions have been that this provided them a safe place to meet with those who understood. They received reliable information. They received healing and support. This leads us to the question of what is our understanding and position regarding homosexuality now. We think, along with the research, that there's about 4% of males and 3% of females that are homosexual. Disregarding nationality, disregarding family structure, doesn't matter any of these things. It just happens to be about that number. We are absolutely convinced that homosexuality is not chosen, which is the current and prevailing feeling. I'd like to quote Dr. William Bine, who is often quoted by writers even in our own community regarding the subject. He said, "I would suggest that the most responsible message that we can relay to the public is that we do not know what causes sexual orientation. But whatever the causes are, sexual orientation is not a matter of choice. In fact, the legitimate literature on attempts to redirect sexual orientation suggests that not only is sexual orientation not chosen, it is, by and large, immutable." We feel that there are a lot of kids hurting in our high schools who are discovering their sexual orientation gradually and that have no place to turn. We feel that our community's leaders are not well educated or versed in the literature, in the research findings. We believe the same of our church leaders. And we applaud the efforts of Dallin Oaks, who has taken it upon himself to study the literature and report what he had learned there. We feel to be advocates for equal rights for all people. We want our kids to be safe. We want your kids to be safe. We want our kids and your kids to have an equal education and the same opportunities. We want them to have equal access to good jobs and be able to pursue happiness as best they can. There's a real danger in ignorance. And in the amicus curiae brief submitted by the organizations of the American Psychological Association, the American Psychiatric Association, the National Association of Social Workers Incorporated, and the Colorado Psychological Association, which was submitted to the Supreme Court of the United States as it addressed the issues regarding to Amendment Number 2 in the Colorado Constitution. One of the final quotes in this brief says this: "Psychological adjustment appears to be highest among men and women who are committed to their gay identity and do not attempt to hide their homosexuality from others. As with other stigmatized minorities, gay men and lesbians probably maintain self-esteem most effectively when they identify with and are integrated into the larger gay community. Conversely, people with a homosexual orientation who have not yet come out and who feel compelled to suppress their homoerotic urges, who wish that they could become heterosexual, or who are isolated from the gay community may experience significant psychological distress, including impairment of self-esteem. Chronically hiding one's sexual orientation can create a painful discrepancy between public and private identities, feelings of inauthenticity, and social isolation." Finally, I'd like to give you a quote of one of the outstanding researchers. He's a well-known sex researcher at Johns Hopkins University. He once remarked that there was, in fact, one easy way to change a homosexual's sexual orientation. This was surprising. Dr. Money, a gruff, no-nonsense scientist who had been active in the field for decades, has amassed a significant body of research, all of which indicates that homosexual or heterosexual orientation is fixed at a very young age, probably by age 2 or before. "Your sexual orientation is something you've got," he has said. "You've got it for good, and you'd better just get used to it." He has then asked, "How then could somebody's sexual orientation be changed?" "Simple," he said. "Remove their brain." So as a final comment, I'd like to say that in a way my presentation here today is an oxymoron to the stated purpose of this session. It talks about children leading into other paths. We do not feel that our son chose to be homosexual. He is not a deviated heterosexual. He is unique in his sexuality. Where he goes from here is his choice, but he did not choose to be where he started.
I remember sitting on my laundry room floor late one night with my two very upset 8th and 9th grade children. Their cousin, a 10th grader, was beginning to experiment with drugs. They were very upset about this, and I felt good about their concern because I knew that they thought it was dangerous, and I thought this would keep them from doing drugs themselves. Little did I know that the very next year I would begin a journey with these very children doing the very thing they were so worried about, using drugs. 9th grade turned into 10th grade with nothing unusual happening, but as the year progressed, I began to have an uneasy feeling that all was not well. So I bought a telephone recording device in which, unknown to my children, their conversations were being recorded. After listening to several conversations, my blood ran cold. My concerned children were beginning to be involved with drugs. My first feeling was shock. When my children came home from school that day, I went crazy. I wonder if they will ever forget it. I screamed, I yelled, I talked and talked and talked. thinking that I, being their mother, had some influence over them. I assumed that if they loved me as I loved my parents, they would do as I wanted them to do. But water ran off the duck's back. Little did I know of the power of their peers. After this happened, I went into a sort of a denial, thinking everything was okay because I had talked to them and I had told them. They'd also been told about drugs their entire life. When people say, you know, don't wait till the last minute, and I thought, hey, I mean, I didn't wait till the last minute. If you think these kids don't know all about drugs by the time they're four, you know, the society is just too prevalent. I thought everything was okay until my son's junior year. He could not get himself out of bed to go to school. And after finding out that he had been staying out all night for probably longer than I knew, he would come home and say hello, and I guess he just went out the window. I panicked, and I put him into a drug rehab program. I felt very badly because by putting him in this rehab, I had made a public statement that my son was doing drugs. I have sad feelings or regrets about this because a lot of the other children that he was doing drugs with never got noticed. They just slid through the cracks, and people just assumed that they were the perfect children. And I wonder if I had not labeled him by doing this, he could have just kind of gone on. There's kind of a way of pretending if you don't make the statement that it didn't really happen. And I see this quite a bit with a lot of people. It just like the ostrich hiding their head in the sand. This may have been my biggest mistake. I really am not sure, you know, if it was or not. After becoming friends with my local police, they informed me that 90 to 95% of the teenagers in our high school had experimented with drugs. About 30% were daily users. This information changed how I saw drugs. And it's kind of changed how the blame that I placed on myself. I had no idea that this was the world that our children are living in, and this is the world that they are living in. I don't think we have one inkling of the influence that this culture has on these children. I really think that children that are straight and don't do drugs are such a minority. They are by far the exception. There are tons of children doing drugs that you would not believe, that you think are sitting in church and that are wonderful little kids that are doing drugs, that have told me they're doing drugs. I still did blame myself for my sons doing drugs, and I will always wonder what I could have done differently. But I should have known that when my son kicked his Sunday school teacher at age four, that I might have some problems. Worse than blaming myself, though, was I blamed my husband for not being there for my children. I blamed him for creating the problems that we were having. This tended to split us apart. And herein lies one of the most destructive results of having a child not fit the mold. It is the potential to tear the family apart. Some families are able to survive a non-conventional child, but I have seen friends and family have a very difficult time. I work with mothers and sons and fathers and daughters, and they simply relate to each other in a different way. My husband thought that I had, because I had such a great relationship with my son, which I still do, that I had the power and the control to make him do what he was supposed to do. But I really didn't have that control. Just because I have a good relationship doesn't mean that I can make him do what he is supposed to do. My son doing drugs, did have a very big impact on my husband's and my relationship. And I don't know exactly how much, but I spent several years separated and came very, very, very close to a divorce. Fortunately, very, very, very fortunately, I did not get divorced. I'm grateful that I didn't. The last thing a child needs is two parents who are split apart and are divided, because it really is not doesn't really help them at all. They need two parents. I felt a great loss because my son had not filled the dreams I had for him. I think that when this happens, no matter what your child does, you go through a grieving process. You go through shock, you go through denial, you go through bargain making, you go through all the steps in the grieving process, because you are grieving a loss of a dream that you have for a child. It just is not going to be. You can't help but have this loss. There are as many ways to respond to a non-conforming child as there are people. Everyone reacts to this child according to who they are. This is such a personal event or reflection on people, what their children do, that most people have a very, very difficult time even sharing, talking about it. Ask Robin how many people she tried to get. You know, people just don't want to talk about it. They don't want to share it. It's just a very, very personal situation for any parent. I guess it's because we just love our children so much. I saw a lot of people in denial saying that this was happening to me, but not them, but I know their son was with my son, so I'm pretty sure that they were all doing drugs. Some people care so much how they appear to other people that a non-conforming child is extremely difficult to them. They care so much what society cares about how they look that it really is difficult for them. Other people don't care as much. Some people don't have strong testimonies, and they don't care if their kids are following the commandments. They might drink themselves, so it doesn't really matter to them if their children are drinking. Or they may be immoral, so if their child's immoral, it doesn't really matter to them either. But some parents have strong testimonies and believe that the gospel is true and that their child's salvation is at stake. They will have a much more difficult time when their child does not follow the commandments. So everyone is going to respond to whoever, to whatever they are and to whatever degree that their values are, whatever their values are. We live in a society, and it is not necessarily the church. In fact, it is not the gospel. It may be the people in the church that measures our success as a parent by the way our children turn out. There is no avoiding this judgment. You just can't get around it. Society will judge us, but the gospel teaches us not to judge. There are many very good parents whose children have chosen a different path. The child is going to be who they're going to be. I have a much greater understanding of some of the gospel principles through this experience. I know that we each have our own free agency, and so do our children. I cannot force my son to do what I want him to do. He has to choose for himself. Thank goodness, I don't want to be responsible for anybody but myself. I have learned a tremendous amount about pride. I really do not care how people see in the outside world look at me. It really just does not matter to me. To some people, it really does matter. After being through what I've been through, a near divorced, a druggy kid, I will never be able to be the model Mormon mother. I've lost that race. But in a lot of ways, I really appreciate not having to be in the race. And it really doesn't matter to me. All that really matters is that my son is alive and well and safe. And that's really what I care about. I have learned to not judge other people and how they raise their children, because they really just don't have as much control as society thinks we have. I have learned not to blame other people. This was one of the biggest problems I had in my marriage, is that I did blame my husband for everything, and it really wasn't his fault. I learned that Satan will do anything it takes to get a hold on our children, and I have learned that Satan is relentless, in going after us. He will use whatever it means it takes to tear our families apart, to weaken the family, and to hurt and injure our children. I have a very strong testimony of Satan, which is kind of an unusual testimony to have. Mostly, I have learned love. I love my son. As much as I love my other children, I adore my son. And I have so many incredible memories with him. He snowboarded and I skied, so I've spent hours and hours and hours skiing with him, backpacking, hiking. So I do love my son, no matter what he does. It is unconditional. As for how the people in my ward treated me, some people acted as this would never happen to them because they were such wonderful parents. But since that has happened, a lot of them, the meanest ones, have had a lot of problems with their children. And I have to laugh. I have to just sit back and chuckle at them. So you have to be really careful what you do to other people, because it can come back. Some people think to this day that their children are just doing great and it's all they're doing, as Robin said. I think you have to be really careful, because you know what? It's not over yet. We don't know what's going to happen in 10 years for this child or 30 years, so I'm not going to judge anyone. I thought people in my ward would look down on me, but quite the opposite happened. People were very good to me. They were very open. They invited me to places that didn't affect their relationships with me. I have grieved the death of a dream of what my child was to be and is not. And now for the rest of the story. What did happen? 8 years later, my daughter did not get into drugs after all. She is a returned missionary, married in the temple, and has a darling daughter. My son is not active in the church, did not go on a mission, which I regret, because I think a mission is an incredible experience for anybody. But he is leading a very productive life. He's helping to run my father's company. He's a vital part in that. He's going to college and is interested in becoming an engineer, as my father was. And from kayaking, parasailing, rock climbing, telemarketing, camping to backpacking, he's always on the go. A lot of times I wish I had his life. He's trying to talk me into parasailing off Mount Olympus. And I said, I think I'm just way too old for that. I have not given up on him by any means. And as the missionaries used to say to us, we were in California working with the missionaries, they said the only way to really get anyone into the church is to love them in. So I will continue trying to love him in. Acceptance is the last stage in the grieving process that I will not go through, because I will not accept where my son is. I will continue to pray for him, to set a good example for him, and to love him unconditionally until the day I die. I have been in a position where people prayed for me and worked me right back to where I was supposed to be, so I'm not going to give up on him. And I love this son. Thank you.
In 1984, we had been living in Los Angeles, and we moved here to Utah. And we had four children at the time, from 15 down to 7. And I thought of all our children that would make the adjustment the most effectively, that our oldest boy, who was just entering high school at the time, would make that adjustment. He had a very outgoing, seemed to me, personality, seemed to be have a lot of friends, and he had always been active as our other children in the church. He had just, in fact, at the time we moved, became an Eagle Scout, and I felt very confident that things would go well. However, he didn't make that adjustment particularly well. And actually, through some friends that he met in our ward, he was initially introduced to drugs through those, some of the associates that are kids that he had met in our first ward. And it was really in his junior year that things became very, very apparent that his behavior patterns were dramatically different than what they had. And as a matter of fact, it was only 2 or 3 months into his drug activity that we became aware that there was a problem. We initially sent him to a psychologist. Well, initially we did some personal activity. My wife started to push me into having interviews with the kids and doing all the things that we were supposed to be doing but had not been. And then that didn't seem to work. And shortly thereafter, we got him to a psychologist. And there were several months of meetings with the psychologist. But the behavior became really serious, and he was having difficulty at school. We got a lot of calls that he was cutting classes. And some of his teachers even mentioned that they were concerned. One in particular concerned that he was concerned with the people that he was hanging out with, and also concerned and was aware that there was a drug problem. And so about 6 or 7 months following this, and there were other things. I mean, he was leaving his room and going out at night, and we found him coming through the window. There was a lot of lying, and he just was very, very sullen and dark. And so... And then there was one major event. He had a girlfriend, and it was actually in May that I was going to work, and I caught him riding his bicycle back early in the morning, and his plan was to slip into his bedroom and avoid any contact with us, but And I really felt at this time that we needed to get him into a formalized program. And so we did that. And actually, though he resisted it some, I think there was a sense that he really wanted this. He was in the program about a month when it was discovered that his girlfriend was pregnant. And so that actually was created a setback in his recovery. But he actually went through the program. It was about a year program. And he did well in that program and really related to the program. And there was a lot of progress made, and he really made an attempt to get himself straight. And then after that, he decided that he was going to marry the girlfriend, the mother of his child, whom we had subsequently adopted, as a matter of fact. She had the baby. She had left after she found out she was pregnant. She had left and gone back to Minnesota, where her mother was. She was living with her father, who was a long-haul truck driver, so there was virtually no supervision in the home at that time. And she went back to her mother. The baby was born. They really had very little contact, my son and Sandy. And we went out there one time out to Minnesota to see the baby. And about 8 months after the baby had been born, we got a call. And the mother said that, "I am going to give the baby up to adoption. Would you like to have him?" We were very enthusiastic about that. And we went out to Minnesota and got the baby. About 6 months later, my son and his girlfriend decided that they were going to get married. She had come back to Utah, and we really tried to discourage that. She had some problems with, and they continue to this day, with drugs and alcohol. But they decided that they were going to do that, and this renewed the pattern. They got together. And it was more drugs and alcohol. And they had some difficulty, making their rent. And, there were calls. And we tried initially to help them out, to support them. However, it just wasn't getting any better. And so we decided to employ the message that you hear in AA a lot, and that is to let God and let go. And we let go. And when he called and he needed some more money, we just said, "We're just unable to support you in this lifestyle, and so there's no money." And he said, "Well, we're going to be tossed out of our apartment." Well, it's too bad. And can't make the car rent. And those types of issues, and it was always, and when I'd put down the phone, I'd weep because I knew I had the means to help him and to pay the rent, to pay the car expenses, and he was working in an ice cream store, and we hardly saw him. I'd go in there, and I recall one time that we just had a sort of an altercation in that in his place of work, and it's really hard to just sort of disengage, and that's what we just decided after 3 or 4 years of trying to support all this, and that we just had to disengage. And the interesting thing is that within, and I can't remember the details, this is going back several years, but within a relatively short time, 4 months possibly, my wife and I were on vacation. We got a call, and he just said, "I'm going the wrong way, and I need to go a different direction." And he told his wife that he was getting off drugs and he was going to go back to school. She was not a member of the church, that he was going to get active in our church, and that essentially dissolved the relationship, and they split, and he did that. I mean, he went back to school, and it's a just, it's a miraculous story, but started going back to school. Actually, he went then to the BYU. He paid off all his debts. He went to that summer to the BYU study abroad in Israel. He met a girl there on the banks of the Sea of Galilee. They decided that they both wanted to go on missions at the same time, and that they would, when they got back, get married. And so when he came home from Israel, he was just really excited about his plans and what he wanted to do. And as it turned out, and it was an enormous disappointment to him and to us, the church would not allow him to serve a mission, and which is still a deep disappointment to me, because here is a boy that fully repented, turned his life around, it is the central principle in the gospel, the principle of repentance and the remission of sins is the core principle in the gospel. And as a matter of fact, and I actually had two conversations with the member of the First Presidency about this, and it was just about the time this all happened. It's probably been 5 or 6 years ago, about the time that they established the policy that not every worthy young person would be qualified to go on a mission. And so, and this, as I mentioned, this is a deep disappointment that his girlfriend went on her mission, and they returned. They got married. You know, looking back, and they have two children. And as a matter of fact, this summer, he never completed his schooling, but this summer he decided that after working for 3 years and being unsatisfied with his work, that he wanted to go back and see if he could get into medical school. And I noticed they're actually living with me at this stage. I've been away from him, although, you know, in contact, but I noticed now that he's living with us that he is a really compulsive personality. I mean, he is as compulsive about school. I mean, he studies all of the time. He never stops studying. He comes home at about 10 o'clock and studies till midnight. And I can see that there is sort of a personality trait that likely could have caused his addiction. I mean, it's an addictive personality trait. And now it's sort of a little bit better directed, but it's the same personality trait that he had earlier on. And so maybe, you know, one of the differences as I've listened to our last speaker was that, and there was the tendency, we had the same tendency, you want to look good, this is a source of deep embarrassment, and yet we just decided to kind of take this on and get it, and I think that there's obvious, we had some denial, I had some denial in this process, but I think we broke through that denial fairly early and just said, hey, you know, this boy needs help, and we're going to be very open about this. And as a matter of fact, I talked to my brother's wife, and I mentioned that I was going to be on this panel, and she stated, you know, one thing you ought to make clear is that you guys were so open about this that it allowed, she has three boys, allowed us to relate to our boys in a way that I think that it had a lot to do with preventing them from taking the same course. And, you know, Brandon was very open about his addiction and dealing with that also. So it's been a very, very exciting experience to see, to have gone through this. I mean, it has enriched our lives, and it has enriched our relationship with him. And I wonder at times if it was the only path that he could have taken to learn the lessons that he came here to learn. And it was a difficult path, and I still feel like there are issues that he's dealing with personally associated with this four-year experience that he went through. But it is his path. It was our experience, and this may seem unusual, but I am grateful at this stage that we have had that experience, and because there is enormous learning that has come through that experience we've had with our son.
Before I turn the time over to you for questions, comments, and discussion, I just want to thank the panelists for being here and sharing their experiences, because let me tell you, I've put together panels for Sunstone before. This was absolutely the hardest one I have ever done. I have talked to maybe 30, 40 people. I have so many close friends I know two who've had sons die of drug overdose. I know so many people, and I was given so many names. The problem is you have a privacy issue with your children. Sometimes it's really, you're dealing with a problem, you just don't want everyone to know about it, or it's so emotional that you haven't fully dealt with it yet. I mean, the list goes on and on for the reasons why people can talk to me one-on-one on it, but could not participate in a panel, and so I do really appreciate the panelists. They did a fine job, and I want to say just one more thing too. I tried to really word this to sound like none of these have really chosen this path. Not the gay son, or even drug addicts and alcoholics. The more you hear research about it now, the more you see that addictive behavior is not chosen. It is part of your behavior genetically almost as much as being gay. And I wanted to also recommend a really good book called Drinking for those who may have someone who is dealing with an alcohol problem. This was an excellent book as well. If you want to make a comment or discussion, I would rather have you come up here so I don't have to repeat the question into the mic so it can be recorded on the tape.
My family is dealing with addiction, drug addiction. I have a sibling who seems to be very much enmeshed in Crystal, who's also gay. It's a rough thing. Please speak to the issue of early intervention. All of the sources my family has been aware of, counselors and reading material, says that we have to let him burn out and watch him burn out before we can extend our hand of love, and that is the best way we can show our love, to wait until he makes the decision to abstain.
Glenn, would you address that? Glenn's the director of Odyssey House, and maybe he can tell us whether... I've always been told early intervention is crucial, so...
Well, this is unfair because I didn't hear the brilliance of the panel. She brought a copy of an article I wrote. I'm executive director of Odyssey House, so at any one time we're seeing a couple of hundred substance abusers. Your question is a difficult. There is no perfect answer. Early intervention is essential, and you should do something that you can do what you can do. But as I sort of said in the article, you need to take care of yourself, you need to support yourself, and realize the limits of what you can do. It's hard to let our children take their personal journeys, and drug addiction is an enormously difficult, painful, self-destructive journey. And as director, you know, I used to be pretty idealistic, but my heart really goes out to parents of substance abusers. I see a lot of people that have been abused, but I've also seen lots of people that have really abused their parents. So my recommendation is you take a very strong stance that there are not, as long as you're living in your home, there are not illicit substances, that you live by the standards of this home, you know, as long as they're reasonable. But yes, when a person's really on a kind of a self-destructive streak, you take a stance, you take a strong stance, this is destroying you, this is what we see, but we can't force you to get help. And then you draw the line. And very often they do need to really destruct till there's enough severe consequences that they'll get help on their own, if that answers your question. I'm not sure that's a gift of love so much as that's all you can do. But if you're constantly, you know, spending time nagging, etc., you often destroy yourselves and the rest of the family. Remember the other family members. So, yes, let them fail. I strongly advise people, let them get arrested. And some people just really take objection to that. But that's one of the greatest gifts, to allow them the consequences of their behavior. Because very often they will not get help until those consequences are so severe that they don't have a choice. So sometimes it's a gift of love to allow them to fail, and you have to let them do that. I don't know if that's, and I don't know if your parents disagree, but that's hard. I had a parent call me yesterday, and they, you know, their kid is 18, regularly using heroin already. And they said, well, we've had him in two programs, but they were too tough, and so we took him out. And so they wanted to know how much recreation we allowed, how many days of the week could he be outside of the program. And I said, listen, you can't allow a kid in that much trouble to program shop. Because if it's a program he wants, it's not going to help him. Because he wants what he wants. He's in the mode of thinking that, you know, life is what I want, and I want my drugs, and I want it easy. And I said, it's not going to work. And I said, well, we'll look further. And I said, that's fine, and wish them well. But they need to stand up. And I think the subject of this panel had more to do, had a lot to do with children that have chosen or not chosen. Not all life is choices, and I agree with you in terms of homosexuality. And certainly there are genetic predispositions toward addiction. So let's not say it's all choices. But people do have to separate, and this is dealing with our own pain. One thing I do want to say, addiction, to just show you the power of addiction, and I should shut up. I'm not even on this panel. But you know, a person, we get chemical releases to the pleasure centers of our brain. And a person who's depressed gets less than 20 impulses. I'll put this in as easy language as I can, per second. Normal people that are living fairly normal lives, it's about 20 to 40. A good downhill skill, supposedly, ski is about 40. They say a great orgasm is about 60, and I don't know how they tested that, because I'm not sure with a bunch of wires to my brain I could experience orgasm, but crack cocaine is like 200 a second. And not only does it deplete the normal ability to redevelop that charge, we can only, those of us that have not abused substance, can imagine the addictive sense of 200 per second charges, and therefore the great crash. So don't view them, the kind of moral judgment, don't view them in the same way that, well, they're making bad choices for themselves. If I were hooked to that 200 and then had that crash, in some ways, yes, it's a choice, but I don't know how much of a choice that would be. So I just want to point out how enormously powerful substance abuse is, the kind of a power that will have over your life. And a lot of people are saying, just get high on life. I think that's a misnomer. One thing a really severe substance abuser has to say is, I will never experience the same high again. And that's a reality. I'll have other highs, and I'll have other ways that bring me happiness and satisfaction, but we won't match that same high. So I do want to bring home to you that addiction is not necessarily entirely a choice, because the thinking patterns are different, and if we are in that same position, we may make that same choice. Sorry for taking time.
Dealing with gay kids is a real tough issue because given the knowledge that they didn't choose to be gay, you can't excuse them for that. There is no therapy for that. But there is one therapy that is always the best, and that's to love your child. It's very important to love them with all your heart.
Robin, since you've got to tell the story. First of all, this child's dealing with something that is just terrifying. That just scares me. Whenever I hear of any child that's really hooked on heroin, cocaine, crack, crystal, whatever it is, it just scares me to hear it. But my children, both of them, before my son went into rehab, would often say, if you don't do this for me, I'm moving out of my home. And they were, you know, we're moving and you can't tell us what to do. Well, when my son was in rehab, he ran away from rehab. So he was out on the streets for probably 4 months. And I had pictures of him plastered all over the city. It was very humiliating. The grocery store. Now, so here are all these pictures. But he was on the streets. The police were looking for him, and he had to run. He was constantly running. He was constantly trying to find a place to live. So he was out on the streets. And I know this isn't as severe, obviously, as a lot of children. We set up an intervention, and we tricked him into catching him again. And we caught him, put him back into rehab. They took him to Las Vegas because he was such a strong leader that he was influencing the entire rehab in Utah and getting all the kids to follow him. So they thought it would be much better to have him go to Las Vegas and be in that program. We pulled him out of the program about 4 months after that. I didn't like the fact that the way they kind of set up with the kids, sleeping arrangements and things, I thought it really wasn't very healthy for any of the kids at that age. But when he came back, he was the happiest kid I've ever seen. When we pulled him out of rehab, he was so happy. He said, I can't believe that you're really doing this. This is a trick, isn't it? And he said, no, we're bringing you home. And we brought him home, and I have never, ever heard him say that he doesn't want to be at home, that he's ever leaving. I'll be lucky if he ever leaves. He's 23. I really don't want him to leave. He can stay there forever, as far as I'm concerned. He will make a move. But that experience did kind of push him against the wall. And I think that's probably the most beneficial thing, that the rehab really didn't do much. But I must admit, being on the street and running, and I mean the police literally chased him at times, did have a great impact. And he finally appreciated what he really did have, and he's been appreciative ever since.
Do I need to come up there? I just want to add something, and maybe it was said. I really appreciate these parents and their courage, and for Robin putting together this panel. But all of us have our journeys, and we all have our strengths, weaknesses, flaws, or differences. I think one of the problems with church culture is that we up the ante because we make children in many ways about us. My mother, who, you know, I gave the book to her, How to Be a Jewish Mother, and she thought it was funny. She didn't realize I was, you know, giving her a book about her. But, you know, it tells you how to hold your hands together to evoke guilt and shame in your kids. But she already knew the tricks. And she was a good mother. But I think one thing we do is we often teach in the church, and I'm a parent, and I take that very importantly, that, you know, if your kids don't make the celestial kingdom, and we define that very, very rigidly, that somehow that is about us. And one of the things that was passed down in my mother's line was never make the family look bad. My grandfather used to write the letters, no matter what you do, honor your family name and never make the family look bad. So there was a great heritage in my family to keep secrets, so to speak, to look good. And I was the therapist in the family, so I got to know the family secrets. But there's this enormous pressure because we up the ante, because somehow if my kids don't go to the celestial kingdom, I won't go to the celestial kingdom. Now, I'm not saying I agree with that. I don't, actually. But that is an enormous trip that I think allows individuation problems. There's many cultures, all cultures have children that take different paths, and that's okay. But we have a particular tough time allowing children, I think as a culture overall, to take different journeys because we make it about us. That somehow my salvation is dependent on my children, and I am flawed if I didn't save them, which usually means if I didn't control them, if I didn't have them question, if I allowed them to individuate. I think we as a culture, one of the issues we have is that we do many things very well, but we have trouble with individuation. We don't allow people to individuate, which is, breaking away and becoming my own person. You can break away a little and you can have an interesting political idea or something, but much of our lives are off limits from individuation. And that's why I think we need panels like this, because we need to openly discuss. We all take separate journeys. And they're, my journey is different than yours, and who knows that it's better. We judge too much and stop building hierarchies. All of us have to take journeys, and I think we need to get over this ante that my kids are me. And I think that's tough in Mormonism, so I just wanted to make that comment.
After the candor of our panel members, I wanted to share a success story. I raised four sons who were tigers, and one of them was unbelievable, like some of the stories you've been hearing. And during his odyssey, he was the student body president and the captain of several varsity teams in high school and went on a mission, etc. And we still went through what you've been hearing about. And I'd add just three amens to what's been said. Number one is don't give up. Probably the best thing we ever did was he always knew we cared, he knew we loved him, but he also knew that there were rules and standards, and he wasn't welcome in our midst if he didn't. Now, for some of you, shudder. Number two is we cut him off. I paid for all the wrecked cars and Bailey's butt out of jail and on and on and on, but when we cut him off was the beginning of all the wonderful things that have since happened. Tough as it was, war at home, but cutting him off was really plus. And third, we did that horrible thing of encouraging different friends. You're running with bums, that's why you're a bum, you're probably the worst bum of the bunch, was kind of the nature of our discussion. But we encouraged some friendships which took, and we watched an interesting transition as what they believed and what was important to them became important to him. And it was lovely, and it's on my mind because within the last week, we spent a lovely session with a cell phone listening to our son bless his first child. And in the circle were these friends who came from all over the country to join him for that experience. And he's told me repeatedly, I'd have probably been right on going with some of the stupid things and self-destructive things we were doing had you not cut me off. And beyond that, the friends that you encouraged really made all the difference. And I know it was a two-way street. They've all told me that they benefited from the relationship. But he's at 34 having his first child and well married, and life is full of great optimism for them now. I say that from parents who had that experience.
I have a lot of thoughts that come out of this meeting, but the one thing that he just said, we've struggled sometimes with wanting our kids to go with better kids, but I wonder what responsibility we have to those other parents not to have their kids go with our kids.
Well, thank you very much for those who participated and those who attended. We appreciate it, and we'll close on time today. Thank you.